The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction and fantasy. I am your host, Beverly Prentice. I hope you enjoy the program. If so, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. A Tale of Two Cities by Julia Rajagopal. It was the best of times, then the worst of times, and we didn't see the change until it was too late. I was in third grade when the fires started. Dozens of people died, and the pictures looked like the end of the world. Our school ran a clothing drive for the victims. My sister Janelle donated some of her less used teddy bears. "They lost everything, Jacob," she told me. "That means they lost all of their stuffies, too." My parents were so smug. "Why would they build those McMansions in the middle of the forest?" my mother asked. "They know it's a fire zone, yet they build there anyway. Nature will always win." "Or it's a punishment from God," my father suggested. My mother rolled her eyes. My father said nothing more, but I knew he believed it. He was the one who had us baptized and took us to Easter services. My parents weren't so smug when the waters came 5 years later. The storm surge came so fast it was like God had dumped a bucket of water on our town, crushing everything in the splash zone. Thousands of people died, including my parents. They were coming to pick us up early from school when their eco-friendly compact car was swept away in the deluge. Before you think they should have gotten an SUV, those were also swept away. The first floor of our school flooded, but Mrs. Mayhew herded us up the narrow service stairs to the roof, where we stayed for 3 days before the National Guard rescued us. We huddled together for warmth, and Mrs. Mayhew taught us to use giant plastic tarps to gather water to drink. I'd say thank God for Mrs. Mayhew, but the second we got to the refugee camp, she bailed. She cried as we begged her to stay, but she left anyway. I think she knew something the rest of us didn't yet understand. "What was that?" the interviewer asked. He is hooked on my story, which is good. "That it's everyone for themselves," I say. The interviewer frowns. "I'm supposed to say we can overcome anything by working together, which is what communities want to hear, but I can't make myself say it." "I heard about that school," the interviewer says. 48 children died there." "Was it that many?" I ask. "I remember 3 kids getting washed away down the street. We watched them from the roof." The interviewer winces, so I put on a traumatized face. I've seen so many terrible things, it's easy to forget. "You were in that camp for 3 years?" the man asks. "Yes, and I am so grateful to God for preserving us," I say. "Those people cared for a bunch of orphans with a kindness and generosity of spirit that can only be inspired by the Lord Himself." I'm laying it on thick, but he laps it up. "Then you left and traveled on foot nearly 1,000 miles to the greater Chicago camp," he says. "That's a big trip for 2 kids to take." We started with 6 people, I admit.
What happened to the others?
They didn't make it, I say. We stopped in Tennessee and spent over 2 years on a small goat farm. A good Christian couple took us in.
Why did you leave? He asks.
It was taken over by a gang, I say. They killed the couple, but we ran away.
And then you and your sister went to Chicago, he says.
Yes. I heard Chicago was rough, but you stayed for a year and a half.
It was rough, I say.
The stories are true. And now you're applying for residency in our fair city, he smiles. It sounds like you and your sister are a couple of survivors.
We respect that here.
And we have your baptism records, which is good. You wouldn't believe the number of people lying about their relationship with the Lord.
We were raised to respect the Lord and live by His holy mercy. I'm not even sure what I'm saying, but it sounds good.
And have you applied to other cities for residency?
He wants to know if we applied to the second city on the godless side of the river.
No, my sister and I wish to live with God, I lie.
We want to live good, God-fearing lives. Our relationship with the Lord is the most important thing.
We are grateful that a sanctuary like this even exists, and it is by the grace of God that we made it here safely.
And last question, what's your favorite Bible verse? He asks.
I am prepared. It's a well-known secret that they ask this to trip up non-believers.
Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Matthew 5:5, I tell him.
The man wraps up the interview and thanks me for my time. He tells me that it will take several weeks for them to make a final decision. But he does tell me I'm good people. I thank him and leave. My sister is waiting under a tree on the banks of the large river. She stands and walks around a group of people.
How'd it go?
I ask her. Before she speaks, she looks up at the giant cement wall rising out of the wet earth behind me.
I think they know we applied to the other side, too, she says.
I glance across the river to the walls of the second city. From the outside, the cities are identical. Enormous cement fortifications rise out of the floodplain. Armed guards patrol the tops of the walls of each city, and the rotting corpses of looters hang from the sides. The only difference is the giant crosses on the walls above them. We walk back to our tent, which is a tarp attached to a branch of a dead tree. It's more than some people have here, but less than others. 2 crates are next to each other.
What time is our interview tomorrow? My sister asks as she sits on a crate.
It's in the afternoon, I say, but we'll have to make the crossing tonight. They don't let people travel between.
I'm ready, she says, though I know she's lying. She hates the water, which is understandable.
3 hours later, it is dark, and we are crowded in an inflatable boat with a dozen other people. The people stink, because even though we live near a river, no one bathes in it. Cholera ran through the camp last year. We cross 1/2 mile upstream to cross, well out of range of the wall guards. The boat bounces jerkily in the waves, and we crouch low because the guards occasionally patrol the river. We land and walk the distance to the city in darkness. The left side of the river is chaotic. People drink and laugh between their FEMA tents, and rock music blares from a small speaker. We join a large group watching a poker game,
when a scuffle breaks out. People start pushing, and knives come out. Janelle and I hurry away. We find a spot next to the wall that is somehow not occupied. Janelle dozes, but I stay awake. At dawn, we walk to the interview tents. Though we have an appointment, we are directed to a line that wraps around the enormous tent. People are seated on the ground, which is a bad sign. The line hasn't moved in quite a while. A woman in a long flowery skirt and an orange vest walks up and down the line with a barrel of water strapped to her back. A hose is attached to the barrel, and she squirts water into the mouths of anyone who wants it. She is careful not to let the hose touch anyone's mouth. The water is clean, if warm, and I drink it greedily before she moves on. The sun is high in the sky when we reach the front of the line. The tent has been divided into sections with worn plastic walls. Janelle gives a small wave as she walks toward another screening room. A petite blonde woman greets me and hands me a protein bar. I thank her, open the bar, and take a quick bite. It's chocolate flavored and dry, but my brain needs the calories. I haven't eaten since my free bowl of soup yesterday morning on the other side of the river. I put the rest of the bar in my pocket. The woman writes something on her clipboard, and I realize the interview has already started. I tell her the same story, but it's different this time. The farm in Tennessee was a paradise after the refugee camp. Built behind a hill on the side of a mountain, we wouldn't have found it, but we were avoiding the road. A caravan of violent fools had blocked the highway that ran along the bottom of the valley. We climbed high on the rocky ground above them, walking hunched over so they didn't see us. It was sunny and hot, and we were out of water. My lips were cracked and sore, and my neck peeled from a brutal sunburn. The caravan had blocked the road and had caught a couple of women traveling alone. We could hear the women's screams halfway up the mountain. My sister cried silently, tears streaming down her cheeks, as we picked our way through the scrub brush. We were exhausted, mentally and physically, and I considered stopping in the sun when I spotted a craggly tree. I don't tell the interviewer this. By some miracle, the tree was an apple tree. I don't want her to think that I am religious, but it was miraculous. We ate several sour apples and sat in the shade of the tree. We removed our worn and holy shoes, letting our raw, blistered feet air out. Then we leaned back and fell asleep in the shade. We awoke to a shotgun being racked above us. "You're on private property. These are our apples," a man said. "You'd better keep moving." He was over 80 years old, and the skin hung off his face as if he had once been fat, but those days were gone. "We don't want any trouble," I said. "Please don't shoot us." "He's not going to shoot us," Janelle said. "If he were, he would have done it while we slept." "I don't want to shoot you, but I will if I have to," the man said. We sat up and gathered our shoes while he watched with the shotgun pointed at us. "Could we have some of that water?" Janelle asked, pointing to a water bottle hanging from the man's shoulder. "We haven't had any all day." The man stepped back, but he slipped the water bottle off of his shoulder and let it fall to the dust. He kicked it over to us. Janelle grabbed it and flicked the lid off. She drank deeply and then handed it to me. I drank the warm water, eyes watering in relief. "Were you with that convoy?" he asked as he lowered the shotgun. No, we were trying to avoid them, I admitted. That's why we're up here. We'll keep going. Thank you for the water, sir.
Finish it, he said. And here.
He reached into his pocket, removed a plastic baggie full of jerky, and tossed it to us.
Thank you. Janelle scrambled over and grabbed the bag. The man stepped back, so we climbed to our feet and started limping gingerly down the hill.
Wait, the old man said. We have some old shoes you can have. Your shoes are so bad you're basically barefoot.
He led us up the mountain until we arrived at a small log cabin nestled behind a hill. It had fruit trees and an enormous garden. A chicken coop with chickens and a shed with goats stood nearby. Howard and his wife Claire were old hippies who had moved to the farm long before the world had gotten weird. When Claire saw our bloody feet, tears welled up in her eyes. She sat us down on the house's front step, and Howard carried buckets of water to us. We were horrified when they told us to wash our feet in that beautiful, clean water. We tried to drink it. Howard got us water to drink, and Claire got down on her old knees and cleaned our feet herself. They taught us everything about farming and caring for goats and chickens. Howard showed us how to fix electronics and maintain solar panels. They became the family we had lost, and we would have lived with them forever, except luck wasn't on our side.
What happened? The interviewer asks. There are tears in her eyes, and I mentally high-five myself.
The convoy finally found us, I tell her. They murdered Howard and Claire. They used the goats for target practice and had barbecue chicken for a week. They held my sister and me captive for weeks, but we escaped.
I don't tell her what they did to my sister. I don't have to tell a woman what happened. She already knows.
The interviewer is openly crying now.
These stories never get easier to hear, she admits. Look, I can't promise anything, but you and your sister have the skills we need in our community. We'll let you know soon.
She gives me several more protein bars and I leave. Janelle is waiting in the sun. All of the shady spots are taken.
How'd it go? I ask.
Really good, she admits. I believe her. She's even better at this stuff than I am.
We walk down to the river and sit on an empty rock. We eat the protein bars, hiding them from the others loitering around us. The dead bodies hanging from the wall above us reek like rotten garbage. And I know why no one is sitting here. Across the river, the walls of the other cities stand, their giant wooden crosses sprouting out at even intervals.
Which city do you want to live in? Jesus Town or Secular City? Janelle teases.
Sounds like we have options.
I don't want to live in either, I admit. They're better than outside, she says with a shrug.
Are they? I ask.
Desperate Remedies by Rachel Henry. When the bombs hit, it was nothing like what we were told it would be. We had been raised preparing for the day the world went up in flames and became uninhabitable. But the bunkers we had been instructed to build collapsed around us. Heavy soil filled my mouth and nostrils. I couldn't tell which way was up and which snapping sounds were the shelves of the bones in my body and those of my loved ones. I clawed my way through the dirt that threatened to suffocate me, and the skin on my hands began to blister, as did every inch of me as I got closer to what I assumed was open air. When I felt no more resistance, I used every ounce left of my strength
to pull myself to the surface. Blood coated every one of my limbs, and the ground was blistering hot under me, but I could rid my senses of the dirt that blocked my breathing. My lungs burned as I coughed up lungs full of damp dirt and blew it out my nose. Tears stung. My no-doubt torn-up face and my body collapsed on the burning ground. Through my blurry vision, I saw the sky ablaze with shades of red and orange. Flames roared in the distance, and the sounds of screams filled my ringing ears. The pain was too much to bear, and consciousness left my body and stole away with the pain. I was dying, and I just hoped my family made it out of this nightmare alive. I woke up to my body being lifted off the ground and searing pain causing light to bloom behind my eyes and a scream to rip from my throat. The hoarse sound was surely coming from me. My throat burned with the effort, but it sounded far off in the distance. Muffled voices surrounded around me, but I couldn't make out any of the human-like shapes that surrounded me. Their urgency made my heart thud harder against my chest. My head spun, and I fell in and out of consciousness. Every time I thought I could finally die, I was ripped back to the surface by the sharp shooting pain and damp cloths with cold liquid sliding down my body. Had the bombs even gone off? Or had the world plunged into hell with the determination that no one was worth saving? My vision slowly came into focus, and all around me were men and women in dark blue. The walls were shining steel, and bright lights shone from either side of me. I could see their mouths moving, but the sounds were still so muffled that I couldn't understand a word they said. So I let my eyes close and hoped whatever torture they had in store, that it would steal my life away before too long. When the pain stopped jarring me awake, memories of my family being crushed and the sounds of breaking bones sent my eyes flying open. I could not move my body, so my eyes scanned the room. A small lamp sat on a table next to a glass of water, and a man I did not recognize sat at the foot of my bed. We made eye contact when he lifted his head to check on me. "Good, you're awake." He stood, and I saw he was wearing the same dark blue clothing the people before were wearing. When he was by my side, he examined my body. His eyes roamed over every inch of me, and I felt so vulnerable in that moment. He shushed me, and I felt the pressure of his hand rest next to me. "I know you're frightened, but we found you barely alive after the explosions. We rushed you to our own bunker nearby and got you stabilized. We had a few doctors on standby to help anyone who survived the initial blast." My mind reeled from the information. I wanted to ask about my family, about why they were so prepared, but all I could do is look on with abject horror as he pulled a large needle from the bedside table. He removed the kelp, and I felt it pierce the tender flesh on my wrist. "We will need to keep you still while your wounds heal. Go to sleep now. If you survive, I will explain everything." Every time I woke up, the same thing would occur with a rotation of men and women attending me. Occasionally, they would gently lift my head to allow me water and thick, cured food. Once I had a few moments awake, they would again put me to sleep with whatever serum they concocted. Time had no meaning as I came to and faded time and time again. My body was unwrapped limb by limb as I healed with their constant care. Each time I woke up, my body cooperated a little more, and each time the person I woke up to seemed astounded that I continued to do so. Finally, I woke up and there was no one there to immediately feed water and sedate me. Still, a murmuring voice sounded next to my head. I turned and saw, for the first time, a radio. A piece of our past that had survived, likely saved by the people who built this place. I didn't know how it was still working, that I needed the company of something other than my thoughts. I moved with great effort and turned the knob until the voice came through clear. A woman's voice echoed through the room, almost robotic, and mild sentence. Recorded message from your leader. My brows scrunched. Did some world leaders survive the blast? They would be the most prepared of us all, I supposed. Static made my ears ring, but was quickly replaced by a booming male voice that set my nerves on edge. If you are hearing this, then you are one of the lucky one and the lucky few who survived. Your soul has been shown mercy, and you have been deemed safe to the planet we call home. Humankind had been a parasite upon the earth. We depleted her resources, damaged her, and disrespected her beauty and abundance. We had to be stopped. It was the only cure for a problem we caused. Now all those who are left can begin anew. Your sorrow for those lost is not taken lightly. You may mourn and curse those who forced my hand. My stomach churned and a bile rose in my throat. I fought through the pain to sit up on my own. A dark blue uniform sat on the chair at the foot of my bed. The static of the radio again drew my attention, and the door opened to the man who had been here when I first woke up in this room. From the radio, the voice echoed, "Welcome to the new world." Desperate Remedies, The Story of Repeats, by Krissa Savars. Did you know that the world keeps repeating itself? Trust me, it does. Every 150 years or so, another perfect copy of you is born and lives its own natural life. It does not have your soul, but the body is yours, down to every blemish and freckle. How do I know that? Well, it's both easy and difficult to understand. I myself am eternal. I'm the first, the greatest of us all. I was born in the beginning of time into the first tribe of men. I watched as our species grew and had my own hand in nurturing it forward, always trying my best to correct mankind when it strayed too far from the proper path. You might put on a judgmental face and ask why my opinion should be held in such esteem, and I have thought about it. The greatest reason I found was this. It's because I know better. When I was created by the powers themselves, they showed me a glimpse of paradise, a world of peace and prosperity. Ever since, I have plotted, schemed, and almost dragged our leaders of the movement forwards. Free will is real, but it's also a big lie. We can choose. We can follow our own path, whichever way we want it to go. But in the end, we are nothing but sheep that follow quite dozily wherever stronger people want us to go. The Middle Ages are a great example of that. So much history and knowledge died during that time. Willful, arrogant men seized control and would not listen to reason. For the grace of God, yeah, They knew that fear would let them play gods, so they did, and the whole of humankind suffered for it. They, or should I say we, suffered just to let them feel important. It was hard to keep a straight face when death came for all of them and dragged them, kicking and screaming, to whatever destiny had in store for them next. The same thing is happening now. A glorified man walks around mocking people, putting himself on a pedestal, announcing people from other countries to be mere animals just because he can benefit from it. Another one started a petty war to seize control over lands that should never be under his thumb. Not now. Not in the age of the peace I was so desperately trying to build up. And it's the same story in other corners of the world. Greedy men doing greedy things for their own amusement and benefits. Most of them trying to subjugate half of the population for being of the weaker sex. All pitiful acts that will be sorted out in the end. If not in their lifetimes, then after their passing. And each and every one of their sobbing and screaming pleads for mercy will bring a smile to me. A sense of justice that the universe will bring to us all in the end. But I digress. What I wanted to talk about was the repeating pattern of our existence. In the beginning, this took me by surprise. I had taken to my bed, quietly meditating, and watching over the land when I saw her. It was like looking into a mirror. The same sand-blonde hair, pale blue eyes that seemed to look through you into your very soul. The graceful limbs, lithe and athletic figure. It was me, but at the same time not. When I was born, I was held up as a goddess. No one had ever seen that hair color or eyes before. Even my face looked different, my features more delicate. A gift from the gods, my parents called me at first. But as the years went by and I didn't seem to age past 18, they called it a curse, that I was a witch. In time, the whole tribe came to fear and hate me, and I was cast out. By then, I was around 30, an age that most thought of as impossible. At 30, you should, as a woman, be weak, starting to gray, the body ruined by hunger, pain, and childbearing. In a way, I was glad to be alone. I made myself a lovely home in a small cave close to a river. The fish was plenty, and all sorts of berries and fauna grew around, a small bit of heaven just for me. Not long after that, I had my first visit with the powers. They explained my purpose and gave me useful things that would assist me with my tasks. I didn't fear them. They had always been around, like a shadow close to the fire or glittering in the morning dew as me and my mother went out to gather food. Watch over the children of Earth. Lead them silently on their way to enlightenment and prosperity. I will admit that I have put forth way more effort towards the prosperity part. It's just not right to streamline other people's beliefs. All of them end up putting their faith in the powers anyways, just with different labels and demands of the faithful. Enlightenment comes from our understanding. How can I make you understand something when I have never been in your shoes? It sounds questionable to me. And as I thought it over and grew into my role as a watcher, I saw her, the first of my repeats. I admit that I followed her life a bit too closely at first, almost losing sight of my true purpose and letting a less than desirable man gaining more power than he should have gotten. But I couldn't help it. There she was, living a normal human life. She grew up, found a mate, and had children. It was a humbling experience for me, watching the life I could have had. And at the same time, it made me happy that this had not been my destiny. Her husband was a brute, who, although loving her deeply, viewed her as property, having her pregnant as often as he could. Some of the pregnancies were successful and others not so much. Their children put a horrible strain on her, and he tried to be away on the hunt as much as possible. With some distance, I have grown to understand that he had, too, his ever-growing family had to eat. When she was too old to carry more children, he pushed her aside and started anew with a younger woman. My repeat accepted her role as the second wife humbly, secretly glad that her life would calm down a bit, taking her place as the matron and educator. When death came for her, she greeted him fondly and never looked back. For me, her death was like losing a small piece of myself, like a dream I didn't want to wake from. After her passing, I lost interest in her family, but strangely felt the need for human contact. Usually I tried to avoid people. All my meddling and communication came through disguises and camouflage, always posing as someone who demanded respect, not as the young woman I really was. Now I crave for someone to see the real me, to establish myself in the world as a person. Maybe I would be able to create real bonds with people, even if they would only last a short while. The first two times it went well. I had wonderful talks with some women out by the river far away from my cave. We shared tips on cooking, moaned about responsibilities and meager harvest after a rough winter and cold spring. The third time I was almost enslaved. We had planned to meet at our spot at noon. I came a little early and waited, thinking of all the things I wanted to know more about. My so-called friends didn't come. Instead, a trio of men appeared. They threw me down, screaming that they knew who I really was, the witch from the plains, the wandering one that stole women and children away in the dead of night. "They are ours," they whispered after looking over my body and ripping off my clothes, "and now you will be too. A witch will make our tribe stronger. Just think of the children we can have with you. Don't worry, wicked one. We will make you a pretty cage at home." I hope you forgive me for not going into details of what came next. These horrid things are etched into my memory, and I try not to think of them. Thankfully, the powers seem to be watching over me. I managed to get away from them, though it's hazy how I did. When I came to, I was home. My body was badly bruised and I hurt. For decades after that, I kept to myself, only interacting in disguise. I was constantly on the move. The population grew and moved around so much that I was at my wit's end. It was excruciating. Finally, the powers came to me and said that I could rest easy. They had seen my plight and remedied it. Instead of just one watcher, now there would be many. When my second repeat was born, I stayed away. My own experiences made me despise her. She was blessed with the innocence that the trio had so brutally stolen from me. I curiously peeked in on the third and saw her die at the age of two. She had been happy, and I was content. All was as it should be. After that, the repeats blurred together. Although I tried my best to keep tabs on them, if not just to be certain that I wouldn't have to interact with any of them and my schemes. As I grew in knowledge, I learned how to set up an alarm, a psychic ping that went off when a new repeat was born. Few of them were remarkable, good and bad lives, children or childless, happy or horrible, sad. I tried to tell myself that this was just the normal course of human life. It happened to everyone. But this tiny little voice in the back of my mind kept pestering me. It's not just a normal human. That woman is a part of you. The powers are taunting you, showing you multiple versions of you that you can never really be. Always with so many yous. Even writing this feels strange. How can you not be you and still be you at the same time? Frustrating, right? Time flew by. We survived the Middle Ages and countless wars. I came to know some of the other Watchers, though we have never really had that much time to just sit and talk. There is always something for us to do, to plot together on our or in our own territories, but as always, we strain for the same goal, a happy, peaceful world for all. And then suddenly, I found myself drawn to a repeat. Everything about her screamed, "Save me." Her rich and powerful parents neglected her. Her live-in teacher used to beat her for every wrong answer, and her life felt like a prison, both from her perspective and mine. The only bright spot in the darkness was one of the younger maids that smiled at her. That a smile would suffice to keep her spirits up brought tears to my eyes. For the first time, I felt justified in doing something for a repeat. This just wasn't fair. I prayed to the powers for an answer, for a way to break her out, if not just for a way to replace the teacher with a kinder one. Their answer was no. This is her life. She will have to endure it. I could feel a crack in my psyche. How could I build up a fair, good world if I couldn't help improve a single person's life? I couldn't step away. I would not step away. They might have spoken, but I would just have to be clever. To put in action a chain of events so innocent and small that it would never be traced back to me. But how? The answer came in the form of a lightning storm. My repeat parents were away, and her teacher demanded that they go out for a walk. She knew of the repeat's fear of being struck down and wanted to have a laugh at her dispense. The poor girl was deathly pale, walking as fast as she could, while the teacher held her back, pointing at the sky and marveling at the show above them. You might ask if they had never been warned about going out in such dangerous circumstances. The answer is yes. Everyone tried to stop them, but the teacher wouldn't listen. She thought she was untouchable. Sadly for her, she wasn't. It was mere child's play to trick her out in the open just the right time. A little piece of gold coin glittering on the ground had her running, and a stray lightning caught her. She didn't die. I'm not that evil. But the shock had her bedridden for days and quickly dismissed from her job as my repeat parents learned of her dangerous outing. They would not be able to marry their daughter off to a suitable man if she had been hurt or, God forbid, scarred in any way. Her life changed for the better after that, still filled with as much sorrow as joy, but never as immorally cruel as before. The powers came to me, demanding to know what had happened, but I claimed innocence. In no way, shape, or form could this have been my fault. And as it turns out, I was in a serious discussion on the other side of the country at the same time as the accident happened. They looked at me with stern faces, clearly suspicious, but said nothing. I kept on doing my job. The powers would forget all about this in time, and time was something that I had more than enough of. Sadly, I was wrong. In my hubris, I thought that my meddling could be hidden, that I could somehow go behind the powers and make my will come true. The next repeat was perfectly lovely and lived a true storybook life without me ever needing to worry about her. In 2001, I did the unthinkable. My repeat should have been working in the Twin Towers as they got attacked. The day before, I had a premonition. I thought nothing of it. It had happened before when the powers needed to warn me of impending doom, but not to stop it, but to be able to recover from it in the best way possible. The premonition didn't even show me her fate. I just knew her. Had kept an eye on her from birth. Too curious in the later years. Aching for a real connection to the world, stupidly living through my repeats and not willing to see my connection severed. She was only 25, newlywed with a beautiful toddler, and had just learned that she was pregnant again. My repeat was so happy, how could I possibly see that happiness die? I set everything in motion. I started by hacking into her work, scheduling her to have a vacation day on the 11th. It didn't work. In the morning, someone had put her back on track. None of my less invasive methods worked. She was still going to be there, still going to die. I thought about blowing something up to stop the traffic. She would still go in, but be safe from the consequences. But ultimately, I couldn't do that. Others might suffer for it, others that I also wished to protect. I would have to be more direct. Stop her myself from entering the building. I put on a pleasant disguise and waited for her. Just as I saw her coming, someone grabbed me from behind and pulled me away. I strained and struggled, tried to yell, but couldn't do anything. I was powerless and crying as I watched her, smiling and happy, walking in towards her end. I'm even crying now as I put the words down. My heart is heavy, and I feel hatred for the world course through me. The powers themselves stopped me, blaming me for failing in my duties. As well as being the first watcher to be born into the world, I am also the first watcher to meddle in things beyond my authority. I'm beginning to see just how flawed their logic is. Their goal is just, but the methods are not. If we would only meddle more, push harder instead of whispering from the shadows, we would be able to create that perfect, just world. We would truly experience equality for all, not just in pretty words from people trying to gain power, but for real in actions. We could see and experience it. I broke away from them. As the first, they gave me too much control and power. They can't get rid of me now. Only hope to control me. I think that it is a time for change. Will you join me?